From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. One of the strongest storms ever recorded battered the central Philippines today, ripping off rooftops, knocking out power and communications, and forcing hundreds of thousands of people to evacuate their homes. At least four have been confirmed killed as Super Typhoon Haiyan, known locally as Yolanda, made landfall and raced across the Philippine Islands, according to officials. The dead included a person killed by a falling tree, two who were electrocuted, and a two-year-old who was struck by lightning. Many more are feared dead as local television stations reported that bodies were washing up on shore and being found along roadways. But the Associated Press said the Philippines appeared to have avoided a major disaster because the storm sped through before causing more serious damage. Last year, the slower-moving Typhoon Bofa killed more than 1,000 people. More than 700,000 were evacuated ahead of the storm, which hopefully limited the death toll. Many sought shelter at evacuation centers set up in 31 provinces. As we reported yesterday, a review of the structure of the UN Security Council was underway in the UN General Assembly by a select committee appointed by Assembly President John Ash, with next month marking the 50th anniversary of the Assembly's first council reform via Resolution 1991 of 1963. Some 50 speakers called for stepping up the negotiations in the opening day of the current session. Delegates focused on various categories of membership, the question of the veto, regional representation, the size of an enlarged council, its working methods, and the relationship between the General Assembly and the Security Council, all of which are under review. One view that was frequently expressed envisioned a more democratic and representative council, more accountable to the General Assembly, with many delegations supporting an expanded membership, including seats for Africa, Latin America, the Arab states, and other underrepresented people. Speaking for the African group, Sierra Leone's representative said the Eswatini Consensus and the CERT Declaration on the continent's inclusion on the council called for no less than two permanent seats and two additional non-permanent seats. Summing up a common view of Africa's inclusion, Guyana's representative, speaking on behalf of the Caribbean Community, or CARICOM, said, quote, "There cannot be a reformed council without Africa as a permanent and equal member of the council," closed quote. Weighing in with their views were all Security Council permanent members, China, France, the Russian Federation, the UK, and the US, who agreed in principle to expanding the council. The representative of China, which held the Security Council presidency this month, introduced the report to the Assembly and, in his national capacity, said priority should be given to increasing the representation of developing countries, in particular African countries, while the U.S. delegate offered a more modest expansion. George Talbot from Guyana, speaking on behalf of CARICOM, noted that next month marks the 50th anniversary of the Assembly's adoption of Resolution 1991, the last time the UN acted on the question of equitable representation on the Council and the Economic and Social Council. At the time, it increased membership of the Security Council to 15 states, including the five veto-wielding permanent members, China, France, Russia, the UK, and the US. There are now also 10 non-permanent members, with five elected each year to serve staggered two-year terms. Although inclusion of Africa, South America, and other regions without permanent representation was proposed as far back as the early 1960s, when both Nikita Khrushchev and Fidel Castro called for a more equitable system, efforts over the past decade include a call by former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan for a team of advisors to come up with recommendations to reform the UN by the end of 2004. One proposed measure was to increase the number of permanent members by five, which in most proposals would include Brazil, Germany, India, and Japan, known as the G4 nations, one seat from Africa, most likely rotating between Egypt, Nigeria, and South Africa, and possibly one additional seat from the Arab League. In September of 2004, the G4 nations issued a joint statement mutually backing each other's claim to permanent status, together with membership by two African countries. To become effective, The proposal has to be accepted by two-thirds of the General Assembly. The current permanent members, each holding the right of veto, announced their position on Security Council reform reluctantly. The U.S. has unequivocally supported the permanent membership of Japan and lent its support to India's membership and that of a small number of additional non-permanent members. The U.K. and France essentially support the G4 position, with the expansion of permanent and non-permanent members and the accession of Germany, Brazil, India, and Japan to permanent member status, and an increase in the presence by African countries on the Council. China has supported the stronger representation of developing countries and has firmly opposed Japan's membership. Meanwhile, today's New York Times reports that the U.S. has lost its vote at UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. The move came 2 years after the U.S. cut off its financial contribution to the organization over the admission of Palestinians as full members. According to Western diplomats and international relations experts, the move undermines America's ability to exercise its influence in numerous countries around the globe through the agency's educational and aid programs. The U.S. Congress enacted a law in 1994, signed by the Clinton administration, which decreed that the U.S. would stop providing money to any U.N. agency that accepted the Palestinians as full members. The military government ruling Egypt plans to hold parliamentary elections in February or March 2014, followed by a presidential election in the early summer, its foreign minister Nabil Fahmy said today. Fahmy told Reuters that the Freedom and Justice Party, the political arm of the Muslim Brotherhood, was, quote, still legal in Egypt, close quote, and would be free to participate in the parliamentary election. Meanwhile, the panel rewriting Egypt's constitution has recommended abolishing the upper house of parliament, the group's spokesperson said. Mohamed Salmawi said earlier today that the 50-member panel voted for an amendment eliminating the Shura Council. This according to the AP. The amended constitution will be put to voters for approval or rejection under a military-backed plan to, quote, return to democracy, close quote. A Japanese lawmaker was reprimanded today for trying to involve Emperor Akihito in politics when he handed the emperor a letter about the health impacts of the Fukushima nuclear crisis. A furor erupted after Taro Yamamoto gave Akihito the handwritten missive at a garden party last week. This was the first such bid reported in more than a century, breaking a taboo against drawing the emperor's attention to politics, according to Reuters. The Japanese parliament's upper house today barred Yamamoto from attending events with the imperial family and issued a stern warning. Yamamoto, an actor and anti-nuclear activist, said he wanted to tell the emperor about the, quote, endangered future, close quote, of Japanese children as a consequence of health problems from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. As the current round of Geneva talks on Iran continued for a second day today, there were reports of hopeful words from several major powers about the possible success of the negotiations. German Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle said he believes that an important moment has arrived in the negotiations with Iran over its nuclear energy program. This according to a source in the German Foreign Ministry. The source also stated that the foreign minister had held talks with Britain's Foreign Secretary William Hague and French Foreign Minister Laurent Fabius regarding the nuclear talks with Iran today. British, French, U.S., and German foreign ministers are in Geneva to participate in the talks, which began yesterday. The Iranian foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, said yesterday that it is possible for Tehran and the six world powers involved in the talks to reach a deal over Iran's nuclear energy program. The French foreign minister said Iran and the six powers have made progress in the course of their talks, noting, however, that no deal has been struck between the two sides yet. Secretary of State John Kerry arrived in Geneva today to take part in the talks. Observers said it was possible to achieve an agreement for a partial removal of sanctions in return for a set of confidence-building measures by Iran. CPR News correspondent Mustafa Afzalzadeh is in Geneva covering the talks. We'll have a first-hand report from him on Monday about the conference. Well, today is Friday, and we have with us our correspondent Tony Solo, based in Managua, Nicaragua, with a report of the news and events taking place south of El Rio Grande. Hello, Tony. How's the weather in Central America today?
The rainy season seems to be extending a little bit more than it usually does, and that's causing public health problems with respect to the dengue outbreak that has been dogging not just Nicaragua but the Central American region and as far as southern Mexico.
Yeah.
For 2 or 3 months now.
Yeah, when you have the moisture, the mosquitoes breed, the mosquitoes carry it, right?
Yeah, and so even when the rains end and the lifespan of the mosquito is usually around 30 to 45 days, something like that. So even when the rains end, the dengue emergency is likely to continue for a month.
Mm, that's terrible.
Mm. Yeah, and here in Nicaragua, we've had the fewest cases of dengue, but the highest mortality rate. It's very strange.
That's interesting.
And for example, in Costa Rica has had many more times the cases of dengue that we've had, but they're reporting just 2 or 3 fatalities, whereas here in Nicaragua, yesterday the government reported the 17th fatality from the dengue outbreak. So it's really very odd the pattern of the dengue attack against the region.
You know, with respect to the prevalence of the disease, not the potency, but the prevalence of it, the defensive measures usually occur in two levels. One, from the healthcare infrastructure, you know, those folks going. You have to suppress the population. So whatever governmental infrastructure there is to work on that, you have that. And then it also requires, because you're talking about, you know, not having pools of water near your house and things like that, mobilizing public activity also. And I would say that probably, certainly in the second case, Nicaragua is better poised than the other countries there because of the heavy public involvement in things anyway.
Yeah, I'm very much so. I was in a because I'm involved in community programs here. I was convocated. I've forgotten the English word. I was told to attend a meeting for all the outfits that are involved in public health activities here in our municipality.
Mm-hmm.
And the local health director was explaining there to us that all the local universities are assigning their students to do educational preventive work out in the barrios.
Right.
On what that means is that you have the whole student population working at least 2 days a week, going house to house, doing preventive educational talk and encouraging people to eliminate the criaderos, what you said, the little pools of water where the mosquito can recreate. And that's, you know, that in itself is an incredible social organization.
Yes.
In preventive terms. And also they're encouraging the removal of rubbish because the mosquitoes will incubate in any little container, even if it's as big as a small bottle top.
Right.
That has water in it, and so people are being encouraged to eliminate rubbish. And the figure that the local director at the health center gave us was that in Esteli over the last month they've eliminated something like 2,000 cubic meters of rubbish, which is an incredible
Whoa.
Figure for such a small population.
Yeah, that's a lot of garbage.
It's a lot of garbage. Yeah.
So. Some of the things going on around there. First, I guess the situation with the constitution in Nicaragua.
Yeah, and there's been kind of a very strange reaction from the right wing here to the proposed constitutional reforms that the government. In fact, it's the Frente Sandinista bloc in the National Assembly that has developed this proposal for constitutional reforms, and most of them are pretty uncontroversial in terms of Nicaragua's political development over the last 5, 6, 7 years, ever since President Daniel Ortega took office in January 2007. And the most extreme elements of the Nicaraguan opposition have been talking about, a consolidation of the dictatorship and all that kind of nonsense.
Right.
And the mainstream opposition in terms of the capitalist business class, has been really quite, they've said virtually nothing about the proposals, largely because the proposals are by no means extreme and are just legitimizing in constitutional terms the de facto arrangements that have been in place for the last 4, 5, or 6 years. So that's quite interesting, because if you look at countries like Bolivia and Ecuador, Venezuela, and those countries had to go through really quite traumatic processes to engage in, to consolidate the constitutional reforms that were necessary to promote the popular interests of the impoverished majority in those countries.
It's still going on. Look at Venezuela, for example, just the last presidential election, the mobilization of the right wing, you know, and how large it is there. It's still a factor.
Yeah. And one of the big differences in Nicaragua, of course, is that the opposition political parties now, they have difficulty, and it seems incredible when you say the figure, but they have difficulty getting 6 or 7% support at national level, and that's all the opposition political parties, because the Sandinista Front is enjoying levels of support, electoral support and popularity.
I think you can look at the nature of the predecessor states in each case, because and the societies, because in Venezuela there was a you had the dictatorships, of course, or whatever form it was, a bourgeois dictatorship, but there was a middle class and there was a domestic bourgeoisie of some size, whereas the nature of Somoza's regime was basically when he went, there went the local bourgeoisie.
it's interesting that And that Nicaragua's history is very special in that regard, because, in fact, large sectors of the Nicaraguan middle class supported the Sandinista Front in 1979 in the insurrections, because they saw that there was no future for themselves as a class under the arrangements that Anastasio Somoza was trying to maintain. And then a big section of that Nicaraguan middle class, through the 80s, felt that their interests were not being represented, and they turned against the revolution, and that was what really made possible the Contra War, which was largely a war fought by Nicaraguan campesinos who were very much used by the Nicaraguan right wing. And one of the very interesting achievements of the current Sandinista government under Daniel Ortega is that he's won over all those campesino sectors that used to support the Nicaraguan right wing, and that's why here in Nicaragua the Nicaraguan opposition parties can barely muster 6% national support.
Yep. You know, if you're looking at Nicaragua's, let's say, nascent middle class and even domestic larger bourgeoisie, one of the reasons that this thing sprang into being and became an opponent, because it actually, you had some new members in that class because there was money coming in from the outside propping some of those folks up, and with the promise, of course, of playing a larger role in what would come next. The U.S. was very involved, and they were spreading money around at that time. Now, that class looks at the development of the working class in Nicaragua, you know, them having discretionary income, being able to buy food, being able to buy clothing, you know, being in the housing market, and they see a potential to actually grow as a class.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely clear, Don. I mean, when one looks at what's going on in the United States and China and the rest of the world, and it's absolutely clear that the arguments of not even very progressive economists, the classic neo-Keynesian argument is that you have to give people money in order to for them to be able to buy things.
Right, exactly.
it's real common sense, isn't it? So all this bogus argument in the United States about the deficit. My feeling is that the countries in Western Europe and North America are so have been so deceived by self-deceived by their own neo-colonialist and imperialist past that they're unwilling to see the very obvious lessons from countries like Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador, and even little Nicaragua. Mm-hmm. That if you give, if you invest resources in the impoverished majority or in the low-income majority, they're going to spend that money. That's right.
Absolutely true.
And so, what's the big deal? What's the big, you know? And it's the debate that one observes in the United States about the deficit is completely unreal.
Yeah.
It's an extraordinary sight for people outside the United States to see such a wealthy country with such an enormous resources impoverishing the majority of its own population. It's totally bizarre.
You know, I was on Crosstalk with Peter Laveau on RT yesterday talking about politics, but I got to the same point that how American politics must be bewildering the people in the rest of the world, because the things that are said about the things that are happening are so disconnected, and yet it's the focal point of public discussion in the United States.
Yeah, and if you look at the U.S. and European rivals like China, and it seems very clear that what's happening currently in the Chinese People's Republic is that the current President Xi, I've forgotten his second name, but President Xi took over from President Hu Jintao about 2 years ago, I think it was, year and a half ago. And what seems to be happening is a reversal of the more open-handed liberal policies of Hu Jintao that pursued the export-led model that had been so successful in the years prior to 2000 and whenever it was, in 2002, 2003, that had enabled China to grow so rapidly. But the problems with that growth is that they end up being dependent on exports, and that is not good for the domestic economy, obviously.
Right.
And so what seems to be happening now under President Xi is that they're trying to escape the trap of being, and I think it's currently the case that China is the biggest owner of U.S. treasuries.
Yes.
And so that creates this double-edged situation in which China is both a victim and a beneficiary of the weird U.S. Monetary policy whereby the United States economy is sustained by selling anybody who will buy them, whether it's foreigners or the U.S. Federal Reserve itself, U.S. Treasury bonds,
right,
to fund its economy. And it seems to me that here in Nicaragua, one of the reasons why is, although it's supposedly a private sector initiative promoting the $40 billion infrastructure project here in Nicaragua of the Nicaraguan Interoceanic Canal, ultimately the force that's backing that is the Chinese financial system, backed up by the Chinese central bank. And that is what makes it possible for people like Wang Jian, the Hong Kong impresario who's promoting this $40 billion project in Nicaragua. That's what makes it possible for him to have access to that amount of money.
Yeah, well, you know what else? Take it a layer out, because if you look at, for example, Chinese investment in that as being money made from exports, then you have basically the American economy funding the canal, ultimately, in Nicaragua.
I think that's probably very accurate. Kind of U.S. economists might criticize it, but it seems to me that that's very much what's the fundamental reality.
Yep. Now, let me go here, because now the next step is, if you look at a Keynesian model, okay, because the jobs were exported to China, and because the money's being loaned to the United States through the Treasury bonds, It's not a sustainable model because the input into the consumers that buy the Chinese goods that produce the capital China has to invest, there are two circuit breaker points that where the breakers are, you know, open.
Yeah, I knew you're losing me there, Don, because I'm not very sophisticated in that kind of economic stuff. But and your fundamental point that ultimately it's U.S. workers, so U.S. working people, that are funding this development, in a very convoluted way through the international financial system, whereby China is trying to. Instead of holding on to bits of paper, it's trying to create physical bits of valuable real estate around the world.
Right.
It's not just in Nicaragua, it's in Africa, it's in Latin America, it's in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, it's asset-based wealth instead of paper wealth, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And so what they're trying to do is to diversify out of the U.S. Treasury bond bits of paper into canals and power stations and refineries and around the world, and they're doing that at the expense of ordinary people in the United States who've been misled by successive governments for something like 30 years.
Yep, that's right. What else? We got about 5 minutes to go. So, what other things are happening in the region down there?
Well, there's so many things that are happening. You mentioned to me in a brief note earlier before we came on air that CELAC is holding, I think it's in Bolivia, they're holding a conference on how to counteract corruption in the Latin American and Caribbean economies.
Right.
And that's, you know, that's probably to be taken much more seriously than the occasional pronouncements from the U.S. government and or the Federal Reserve or whatever about, you know, the battle against corruption. And if you look at U.S. Regulatory efforts to rein in corruption in Wall Street, and they're continuing to uncover these incredible illegitimate illegal scams. I mean, the latest one is that apparently the international currency markets have been manipulated by the very same major corporate players that were manipulating interbank lending rates.
Right.
No, and that's the latest one. And so, you know, how many more scandals can the Western European and North American financial system take before it collapses?
Yeah,
How long are they going to carry on bailing out? Because that's essentially what's continuing to happen. How long are they going to continue bailing out Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs? How long are they going to? It's just completely unsustainable. And at some point, it's going to collapse.
Yeah.
And what will that mean? What that'll mean basically is that the multipolar world that leaders like Evo Morales and Nicolas Maduro, and before them, our eternal Comandante Hugo Chavez, Fidel Castro, Daniel Ortega, all these leaders that are kind of sneered at by the Western corporate media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, you know, whenever you read an article about Latin America in any of those NATO propaganda outlets. The impression that you get is that Latin America is being led by a bunch of idiots.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the impression that they try to give you. But in fact, it's those extremely wise statespeople like Fidel and Hugo Chavez and Daniel Ortega, Evo Morales, Rafael Correa in Ecuador, who are leading their countries into what the Sandinista party hymn calls a land of milk and honey.
That's right.
You know, they're leading their peoples to prosperity, and the contrast with North America and Western Europe could hardly be more stark.
We got to stop it there, Tony. We're running out of time. Always a pleasure, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Take care.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening. We'll